Hello, my name is Victor Mrinde. I'm the AXA professor in global finance and also the director of the Center for Global Finance at SOAS University of London. And also, I'm the incoming executive director of the African Economic Research Consortium, which is a think tank, Pan-African think tank headquartered in Nairobi. It's a great pleasure to welcome you to this important seminar. And the seminar is organized by the Private Sector Development Research Network, the PSDRN, and hosted by ODI London. And ODI is a member of the PSDRN. The seminar is very critical and comes at a very, very important time when food security is at the core of our current discussions. Maybe the focus on food security started many years back. But now there are so many imperatives why food security is critical and why it's high time that we focused on A, understanding the issues of food security, and B, designing solutions at the heart of addressing food security, specifically with respect to our fragile states. And so the topic here today is the role of development finance institutions in addressing food security in fragile economies. And there are many imperatives why this is important or very timely. One is because of the nature of fragility in economies and the coexistence, of course, of food security in those. There is, in many ways, a feedback mechanisms between those two elements so that as fragility becomes much more intense, food security becomes an issue, and maybe food security also tends to push fragility in many other dimensions. So this provides us an opportune time to do so. And one of the important questions in the debate concurrently around the world is to see whether the availability of financing, and especially the variations in financing, the innovations in the financing mechanism, the availability of liquidity to go directly into removing some of the bottlenecks that address food insecurity. And we need to look at that question of investment, types of investment, the timeliness of investment, the tenure, how long it would be, the quality of investment. So this is why this debate and the seminar becomes very timely. You could think of many countries in Africa where the issues are much more pronounced than anywhere else. But also, you could look at many countries around the world. For example, the 10 plus one countries: Afghanistan, Central African Republic, DRC, Ethiopia, Somalia, South Sudan, Syria, Yemen, Burkina Faso, Chad, Mali, Nigeria. Here you can find important case studies on what is happening on food security, the gravity of the problem, but also the coexistence of food security and economic and national fragility, and trying to go to the core. So today we have the debate going on, and we have also been very, very fortunate to have a number of speakers who will address various dimensions of this issue. And we shall allow or leave enough time for to invite you to also bring in questions and views into enriching the discussions. I would like to mention before we proceed one important housekeeping issue that the seminar is being recorded, and the recording will, of course, be made available afterwards on the ODI website for all of us to reminisce and see how the debate goes. And also to continuously think about these issues, because this is just to provoke discussion and to highlight the status quo of the debate and then open avenues of thinking, financing, addressing policy frameworks that can go at the heart of the problem. Okay. Now, it's at this juncture, I would like to have the pleasure of introducing the keynote speaker, His Excellency Salah Ahmed Jamal, who is the Deputy Prime Minister of the Federal Government of Somalia. His Excellency took on the role of Deputy Prime Minister for the Federal Government of Somalia on August 2, 2022, after a remarkable and distinguished career in the public service, having served in the cabinet in two previous different capacities, first as the Minister of Labor and later as the Minister of Constitutional Affairs. He is therefore in very good position of understanding the issues, the core issues in this debate, and also helping us to think actively on not only the understanding the structural issues, but also the policy dimensions. And I know we have a wide audience that which I have welcomed, both mainly from all parts of the world and online, and from different backgrounds. You have academics, you have policymakers, you have practitioners, you have bankers, you have financiers. So, and it's a great pleasure that we have the opportunity to listen to what His Excellency Salah Ahmed Jamal will be sharing with us on these issues. Let me address you, Your Excellency, and let me have the pleasure of inviting you to please share the insights from Somalia's perspective on the challenges of food security within fragile context and the potential of development financial institutions, DFIs, to play a role in fostering solutions, financing, and even beyond the financing. Your Excellency, you have the floor.
You're on mute.
Am I able?
Yes.
Hello?
Yes, now we can hear you very well.
Yes, it's indeed a very great honor for me to be among you in discussing this very important subject matter. Let me clarify a few things here. I am usually approaching this topic from a different perspective, the topic of food security, mostly from a humanitarian perspective, from a governance issue point of view. And I think this opportunity gives me the pleasure of hearing a very nuanced perspectives from different practitioners, particularly from the world of investment and finance, which is very vital for us to understand as a government, as we try to find durable solutions for this predicament of food insecurity. Just to give you a context of why Somalia is among these dozen countries that have been identified as the most prone to food insecurity, ranging from the Horn of Africa, Somalia, Ethiopia, to the Sahel regions of Niger, Mali, Central African Republic, Yemen, Afghanistan. These countries of ours share a set of a very particular and peculiar and variables. There has been a history of political instability, societal upheavals, conflict, and then compounded by climate change shocks that are reoccurring again and again. As I was reading the report produced by ODI, a very interesting report, and dwelling on the questions put forth as to what role can DFIs play in coping with food insecurity in countries like Somalia, I really have to think hard and deep about why are we not having enough role for DFIs as we speak now. I think that is where I should start my discussion from. Their absence and their inability to invest in the private sector is one of the key indicators as to why we're having food insecurity, because there's not enough investment in the productive sector, generation of capital in the form of FDI, is a bit difficult, so perhaps that missing link is a starting point. As you know, Somalia has had a history of over 30 years of dealing with either state failure or fragility. But as we currently speak, we have a government that is functioning with some limitations, fighting off Al-Shabaab very successfully, trying to put in place a national development plan. We recently finalized our HIPIC initiative for debt relief and process. It was only a few months ago when we were able to finally conclude that over $5 billion of debt that we had to find a settlement for. And through a rigorous process of over 10 years, we were able to finalize that. And we were one of the last countries to successfully complete that. So we are a society of over 15 million. We just concluded a debt relief program. We're fighting off a very potent terrorist force in the name of Al-Shabaab. We are trying to create productive opportunities for our society. As we try to, citizens, as we try to do all that, we find ourselves in persistent in the form of either floods or in the form of looming famine because of droughts. Just to give you some context, because some of the questions raised is, what are the drivers of food insecurity in Somalia? In the last 30 years, we have had more than 18 droughts and almost equal number of floods. Before, in the 80s, 70s, or before that, droughts used to occur every 10 years, if not 20 years. In fact, we had names for them. But now they have become the norm, not an emergency, not a disaster that occurs one off at a time. It has become a norm. So we have a situation where the citizens that were in the most productive parts of Somalia, in the agrarian and pastoralist communities, are moving in the hundreds and millions away from, as we speak, we have over 4 to 5 million Somalis that are in a perpetual state of internally displaced people. And that number is only increasing with time. As we speak, annually, every time, there are at least over 4 to 6 million people who are at the risk of food shortage related, you know, consequences that may arise. And as all those things are happening and making our citizens caught in this vicious cycle of poverty, the room for investment is also constrained because of the debt issue that was in place, lack of access to global financial instruments, such as you mentioned in the earlier discussion, the Green Climate Fund and you know, climate finances. So where are we now? And what are we trying to do about this? We have our 10th National Development Plan that the government has put in place. And at the center of it is a poverty reduction strategy aimed at the productive sector. Somalia is not one of those countries that has not been endowed with natural potential to produce food for itself. We have a coastline of over 3,300 kilometers, and annually we could generate over $300 million from fisheries. We have over 15% arable land. We have two rivers, and we have a livestock that is over $65 million. But in the era of climate change and shocks, 5 million of those 65 million can just vanish in a matter of one season. For instance, last year, I witnessed a family that lost not only livestock, but the life of members of the family, either in the form of floods or because of droughts. So the question is, how, as we sit in the government tables and think about it, ways to find ourselves out of a humanitarian crisis, most of our day-to-day activities are aimed in dealing with OCHA, World Food Program, in responding to crises. But I would like to acknowledge that institutions such as the World Bank, among others, and the FCDO have been able to devise with us a set of programs and projects at a regional level and national level that would help us to look at this food insecurity in a more systemic and prolonged manner. So we have a food preparedness program with the World Bank. Through its analytical capabilities, we were able to identify that we're investing over $1 billion every year or every season when a drought comes in humanitarian response. What are we investing in productive sector? So we have initiated a set of small scale, albeit preliminary and programs that would help livelihoods, productivity. I must admit that Somalia is not, I was in Zambia not that long ago, where there's large scale farming and production. But in our case, these are small scale subsistence farming. So to answer one of the questions, and I don't want to take a lot of your time, is how can the DFIs intervene? Do we invest in small scale farming or large scale? I think it's going to be a combination of the two. One of the key impediments, and let me highlight the four challenges that directly have a consequence of production in terms of food security. Number one is the issue of water. In Somalia, it's to any form of production of food. So we have identified infrastructural intercatchments as a necessary policy area of investment in terms of food security. Another area is transportation. And I think we have put in place a number of programs with the World Bank and African Development Bank to ensure that transport of goods and services from the productive sector areas to markets is available in terms of value chain and supply lines. As we speak, 70% of food consumed in Somalia is imported from outside. And those include the most basic staple meals of the day. Those are things that can be easily substituted. But I must admit that prior to now, there were very little policies, regulations, and legal frameworks in place to allow FDIs to invest. And also, they also had the problem of not finding a large enough firms who are able to bid for or put forth a proposal that is, you know, in the millions of dollars. So now there is an emerging space and room for a collaborative work between FDIs and the government and the private sector to identify bankable projects. So water, energy is another problem. It costs over 44 cents to produce one unit of electricity in Somalia. In other places, it's less than 11 or 5 cents. So energy is also another impediment. And now we're investing heavily in solar and other alternative forms of energy. As we speak, over 70% of the Somali population are unemployed. And some of the research that has been done in terms of why are people not working in the agricultural sector is that traditionally in the past, it used to be a very nomadic countryside, non-systematic approach of rearing livestock. But now to invest, as we export over 4 million livestock to the Arabian Gulf, we can double that, but it needs investment in infrastructure, in value chains, in marketing, in digital development. So a series of policy options have to be put together in order for us to allow both a grand level production of food and also a sector level production from fisheries to farming to agriculture. I will leave my opening remarks to that and conclude with the fact that in a post-HIPIC world, where we are going to have access to concessional loans and finances, perhaps now we can invest in a meaningful way the foundations of food production. And one of the key issues highlighted in the report that you guys have presented is how can we blend DFI financing with concessional financing? Maybe that is one area of looking into it. The private sector. Ladies and gentlemen, in Somalia, of a viable state institutions in the past. They have invested heavily in technology, telecommunications, what do you call, money transfer systems. I think it is about time that they move towards food systems. The right know-how and support and collateral damage will really help us in highlighting the need to go down that direction. Thank you very much.
Please join me in giving a hand of applause to His Excellency Sara Ahmed Jama for the constructive intervention. Yeah, quite briefly, His Excellency pointed out right from the start that we should have a strategic central role of DFIs for investing in the food security area. His Excellency also pointed out a number of areas where Somalia has made very tremendous achievements in spite of all the challenges, both from security and also in spite of the challenges like climate change, persisting. And kept on coming back to this question of how can the DFIs intervene, especially in infrastructure for production and supply chain, and added on a very optimistic note of saying that post-HIPIC, there should be a form of blended financing to help intervention in this area. So thank you very much, Your Excellency. At this juncture, I'd like to have the pleasure of inviting two speakers who will give us a further discussion in this. First of all, Professor Dirk Willem T. Verde, who is the Principal Research Fellow and Director of the Economic Development Group at ODI, and is also a professor of practice at SOAS University of London. You are welcome, Dirk. And I also invite Ms. Vivian Infante, who is in the top management of the British International Investment and is actually the coverage director for Africa at the BII, and has long experience, high structural experience, and familiarity with the issues in the Horn of Africa. So we have these two distinguished speakers who intervene. So let me, first of all, call upon Professor T. Verde, who will share with us the research report and highlight some of the several key issues for potential DFI intervention. Could you expand on those areas, taking cue from what His Excellency has just highlighted, and discuss, for example, issues of why productivity improvements and investments are crucial at this day and age?
Thanks. Thanks so much, Professor Morinda. And thank you also very much indeed for a wonderful opening remarks, Excellency Deputy Prime Minister Somalia. Let me discuss in about 7 minutes or so some of the findings of the report that we've done. It's a SPARC report undertaken for FCDO with a number of colleagues at ODI, including Steve Wiggins, Alberto Lema, Sharon Draga, but also building on analysis undertaken with local researchers in both Ethiopia and Somalia, and also in other countries as well. And I think the Deputy Prime Minister highlighted the major challenges that are out there and on food security, in particular in the Horn of Africa. And there's many symptoms, causes of this. And of course, there's in several countries, there's a lack of food availability, poor harvest, for example, and in others, it's the availability, the or affordability that is the huge problem, which perhaps may be exacerbated by elevated food prices in the recent past, and of course, through persistent poverty challenges, not being able to afford food, and particularly in those countries, and Deputy Prime Minister was talking about. Imports that Somalia has become much more import dependent, and so that become also quite difficult if you need to finance all that. So our report does suggest a role for DFIs, development finance institutions, who support the private sector, so private sector firms, to address concerns, these concerns on food security, in two different ways, and complementary ways. One is to address that food affordability issue, which is increased incomes, right? So if you are, as a DFI, invest in an economy and that has a payoff, you increase the productivity in that economy, you will help to raise sustained and sustain income increases, and that will help you to be able to pay for food as well. And I think also the Deputy Prime Minister was talking about the emphasis he's placing on the productive strategies to overcome some of the challenges. Now, there's also an additional way, of course, in that DFIs can address constraints directly in food systems, which can be around production. It can be about facilitating imports or particular inputs of food. It can be around storage, distribution, processing, and retail issues. And we've highlighted how DFIs affect individual modes and nodes in the value chain, for example. And we've looked at 10 plus one countries, which the Professor Marinda already introduced, which is sort of 10 countries and one sort of region, so Sahel, Burkina Faso, Niger, Mali, and Chad. But Somalia is one of the countries that we looked at. So we identified, first of all, some private sector opportunities in the current context around addressing food security. And we identified a range of options, and which are highly complementary and emphasize also the opportunities that the Deputy Prime Minister was already highlighting through a range of areas. For example, he mentioned transport, and I think so investing in ports and storage and in parts of the port operators to expand grain and bulk storage facilities was one of the issues that was highlighted as a private sector opportunity. There's other issues around food processing to reduce food imports. Trade finance issues have also come up in Somalia. Now, in Ethiopia, other issues came up, but it does highlight from our perspective that there were sort of profitable opportunities for the private sector to invest, but which also help to address the concerns of food security. And so that there is a private sector solution to some of the challenges that were being highlighted. Now, if we then look at the reality in terms of how much investment there is, and also in terms of the support mechanism behind investing in the private sector, i.e., the development finance institutions, which is the topic also of today, we do find that DFIs mostly invest in countries that are not the most vulnerable, and so they have maybe only sort of the if you look at the bilateral development finance institutions, the European development finance institutions, they invest about 10% of their portfolio in a more fragile context, and I see, I think there wasn't really data on the same portfolio level, but more on the accumulated flows. Then that ratio is actually even less, more like 5%. But there's of course huge variation across DFIs, and some are investing more heavily in the more poorer, vulnerable context, and BAI included. And we will hear more on BAI in a minute, but also FMO, for example, and others. Now, what we also did was we looked at the main DFIs, and we looked at how much they are investing in the 10 plus one countries that I just highlighted at the beginning. And we looked at both multilaterals and regionals, so the IFC, for example, and the private sector windows of some of the regional development banks. And we also looked at the bilateral DFIs, and then looked at their individual investments, and then looked at the past decade or so, how much of their investments were in the 10 plus one countries, so ranging from Nigeria, Ethiopia to Syria, Central African Republic, Somalia, Sudan, and so on. And we counted around 511 investments by DFIs in these countries, responsible for more than $14 billion. And we calculated that was about 5% of the overall portfolio that the DFIs, those DFIs that we looked at, invested. If we take out Nigeria, because that was the major one in this stemless one, then that's only 2.5%. So only 2.5% of their portfolios invested in the more fragile contexts. But at the same time, there are these investments, right? So we have 511 investments. So it's not impossible, but it's tricky. It's very difficult, of course, but it's not impossible. Investments were mainly through the financial sector, infrastructure, and much less so through the agriculture sector and the manufacturing sector. Now, from these 511 investments, we counted 37 that were directly related to food security. And so we highlighted these two different complementary routes. There's both the incomes increases route and also the looking investing in food systems. There are interesting examples out there of both individual companies that are being supported as well as strategies that are being devised by DFIs. So there are some prominent examples are fertilizer production companies in Nigeria, which can help to both reduce imports of fertilizer, but also helps the agriculture sector. And it does attract quite a significant amount of DFI investments. There's also interesting examples of Ethio Chicken and helping to your chicken, which has addressed the food security constraint. And there are also major investments by the IFC in the HSA, as a sort of a food conglomerate in Yemen, which has been a long-standing conglomerate already existing in existence for more than 70, 80 years. And so these do attract DFI investment. They do exist. And there are a significant amount of strategies out there amongst the DFIs to address these. But more needs to be done to operationalize this. And that's where I will finish off in these three points. What are the ways in which I suggest and the team that implemented this project would suggest are important to get DFIs more focused on the more vulnerable context? There are three ways. So first of all, just general support plus specific support that complements DFI investments. So here, it is really important to create conditions for viable firms to emerge. What are the good firms? How can they be created, as it were? How can they be prepared to be ready to receive development finance? This is good development policy. Any country is engaging in this. And if you create the conditions for growth, if you can create the conditions for good quality growth, those high quality firms do emerge, and they need DFI investment. That's on the general support. Now there's also an emphasis on more work on the supply side. So this general support is more on the demand side. So you raise growth that needs finance, and then you have this virtuous circle. But there's also the emphasis on the supply side, which looks at DFIs and arguing that blended finance is needed, and that's what the Deputy Prime Minister highlighted. And so often DFIs need to make a profit. And so if you loan 100 or if you invest 100, you want to get at least more than 100, well, more than 100 back. But it doesn't always happen. And if you look at the DFI's history and in recent seminars, certain chief operating officers of development finance institutions said that if we invest in low-income countries, and particularly in a more vulnerable context, we make a loss. And so you may need to have to add concessional resources to this in various ways, either just directly to in financing way, or perhaps support the strategic capacity for DFIs to invest. And we hope to hear more on the example of ARIA from the BAI in a minute. But that basically, that you have targeted technical assistance to help prepare projects, to develop the pipeline, to make the companies ready for receiving development finance. And thirdly, the final one, which has also come up in these discussions, and we've highlighted this report in various contexts, including in the context of Somalia, but also in others, which basically highlights that when DFIs need to invest, there are these shareholders that require that really want to push the advice into the more vulnerable context, but at the same time mandate them to have a whole list of regulations and to be put in place, which makes it very difficult to invest as well. And maybe a look at what is not appropriate, what are the appropriate regulations in this context, is also going to be important. And if you bring all these three issues together, you may have a good context for designing like a platform that can help to, on the one hand, think about technical assistance to provide the opportunities for firms to emerge, that at the same time also can help to blend finance and supply that, for example, through areas such as AgDevCo, and then also where the advice can become more lenient. Let me stop here and then hand over to some of the others.
Thank you very much, Doug, for very, very timely interventions and also adding on more richer information to His Excellency's earlier intervention. Let me say that at the end of the intervention from His Excellency, I didn't find any questions in the Q&A, but perhaps before I call upon Ms. Vivian Infante, maybe let me go back and see whether there is a burning question before His Excellency, while he's still around with us. If there is any question, I will take it. And then after that, I'll come back to you, Ms. Infante, if you don't mind. Meanwhile, also people are mobilizing any question, or you can simply just put up your hand. There is a raise hand a button on this facility. And once we see your hand, they can invite you. But meanwhile, let me also have a quick question to His Excellency Sir Ahmed Jama. And this is the issue that global finance may be available, and the private sector financiers like BII might be prepared to fund various interventions, including infrastructure. But a lot depends on the regulatory framework and the regulations on investment, the policy framework being set up in the recipient country. And I don't know whether we would be like to say something about the policy framework being a strong incentive for investments into the private sector to support a food security in Somalia. You have anything to add in that dimension? The policy framework, the enabling environment, and other issues which traditionally affect private capital, attract private capital into niche sectors like food insecurity. Your Excellency.
Well, gentlemen, thank you very much. I think that is a very, very important question. For us, we have come to realize that I used to be part of the government well before this mandate as the Minister of Constitution and Labor. And we came to the realization that without the appropriate and set of regulatory frameworks, legal frameworks, and policies in place, attracting foreign direct investment or investors to Somalia would be quite a task. In addition to the insecurity, another challenge that prevailed. So one of the first priority that this government has identified as a top national priority is, of course, creating a secure environment by eliminating the remnants of the terrorist group Al-Shabaab. And the other set of activities that we have done in the last 2 years is like putting in place the Investment Promotion Act, the Investment Protection Act, legal frameworks that would govern the private sector, Data Protection Act. So a whole host of legal frameworks from various ministries have been passed through the cabinet and were endorsed by the parliament and have been signed off into legal frameworks. And of course, regulatory frameworks and certain authorities and agencies would be put in place. So we are striving very hard to make it seamless for investors to come and invest in Somalia and not necessarily face the bottlenecks and the red tapes that become quite an impediment to investing in Somalia. And in addition to that, we have a very vibrant, creative private sector that can partner with international entities. As we speak now, there are a lot of investments in, for instance, the establishment of abattoirs for exporting. We directly used to export livestock to Saudi Arabia, you know, Dubai, Oman, and elsewhere. But now we want to process it and export it in that manner. There is a joint investment in the arena of, energy and whatnot. So there is no shortage of policies, and the political will and the thinking is there to establish a viable, conducive, and an attractive environment for investment. But we really need to disseminate the kind of findings and information that has been presented here to a wider global audience so that they can come to Somalia and see the opportunities. So thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Your Excellency. You have put out the message there. The message is very clear. The policy framework is in place and investments can flow into the food security area for Somalia. Thank you very much. If you could bear with me, Your Excellency, for one other question. The question is coming from Ms. Sandra Martinson, and it says, a lot of investments in food and agriculture are actually for export. Why does the big share of population suffer food insecurity or even hunger? How can one justify export production when productive capacity could instead be used to support local needs? This is a question in the audience. I don't know to what extent may be applicable for Somalia, but if you have any views on this, could you briefly, highlight those divergences of producing for export versus producing for home consumption? Thank you, Your Excellency.
Well, in the case of Somalia, there are only a few industries that were traditionally meant for export purposes. One of them is the livestock, the other used to be bananas, and now in the form of maybe sesame and a few others. So we have over 65 million livestock, and we can afford to export quite a number of them every year. And in return, we get hard currency, and we get to have, balance of trade issues there. That is the livestock. But I agree with her that in terms of grains, maize, green beans, and few others that need to be produced locally, and that is what the Somalis consumed on an everyday basis. For those, we must come up with strategies that would empower small-scale farmers so that they can produce, and maybe, as the professor has highlighted, when we fix issues of storage, issues, various aspects of the value chain, we can bring them to the market. And in this case, the market does not have to be. I mean, if you can export it, it is an icing on the cake. But if you can at least bring it to the big cities and Somali consumers, that would be more than enough. We import about 70% of our food now. So we can really reduce that. And we can produce it at a reasonable rate. And as I mentioned earlier, one of the key challenges is the issue of energy. And now hundreds of, millions of dollars have been spent on alternative energy. So maybe the rate of producing electricity would be diminishing with time. And then it can have an effect on industrialization at a small scale. Fisheries is another area. We can both consume it locally and export it. So Somalia is not one of those countries where export industries is a problem. Maybe the shortage of it is a problem. So thank you.
Okay, thank you so much, Your Excellency. Let me now get back to the interventions with apologies, Madame Infante, for the late comeback to you. But I have introduced Madame Vivian Infante, the coverage director for Africa at the British International Investment and long-term experience in the Horn of Africa. You have the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Morinde. I really appreciate this invitation. It is a privilege. I guess I can start by saying that there is a lot of room of agreement between what BII, the way BII, British International Investment, sees the issue of food security alongside what has been discussed by His Excellency, as well as with Mr. Dirk Willem Tevelde. So, I mean, very briefly, I know that we are short on time. We really see food security as one that features in almost everything we do at British International Investment. As you know, we are the British Development Finance Institution. We invest in private businesses in Asia, in South Asia, and in Africa, and have been doing so for the last 76 years. So as was very well laid out, food security is a multidimensional matter, and it encompasses a number of the sectors and ways of doing things from an investment perspective. Let me jump quickly into the way we see this by way of examples. So imagine when you think about investment in food security, the first thing that may come to mind to anyone would be, so you must be investing in businesses pertaining to food and agriculture. And that's absolutely right, except that when you think about this as a multidimensional matter, there's more to it than just food and agriculture, as mentioned earlier. So if you think about, let's say a DFI investing in a business that grows tomatoes, for the sake of an example. Those tomatoes are grown, and they may be wonderful and excellent for distribution within a nation, or even for export. But what if what do you do with these tomatoes if the growing business is not able to rely on appropriate roads? What if that business does not have access to proper infrastructure, let's say, such as good access to energy, right? So when you think about food security, you're thinking about food itself, but also how that is transported and how that relies on energy and even access to internet and proper mobile phone technology to be able to excel as a business within the private sector of that particular country. And it was mentioned earlier by His Excellency the issue of smallholder farmers, right? There's absolutely nothing wrong with smallholder farmers, but when you think about the issue of food security, you're thinking about making food available to wider, large segments of the population. So you think about supporting businesses that are best placed for that, supporting mechanization, improving systems around fertilizing and around food distribution, right? So to give you an example, not long ago, BII invested in Dal, which is a conglomerate in Sudan, and we invested for the import, to support the import of 280,000 metric tons of wheat annually for to provide crucial food supplies to millions in Sudan. And to the extent that has been possible, even within the current conflict, this conglomerate has been able to fulfill its goal to produce bread to distribute even within these current circumstances in Sudan. Another example relates to what if that tomato growing business, to keep the same line, is wishing to access credit because it's doing really well, but it needs to access credit in order to grow or to import equipment to be able to process tomato and create tomato paste within its country and maybe even for export. So in addition to everything I've just said, supporting infrastructure, supporting energy, supporting food and agriculture, we also need to think about supporting lines of credit, supporting banks to focus on these perhaps underserved clients. It could be the SMEs, it could be those that are above SMEs that are looking for credit to be able to grow. Again, DFIs and speaking from BII's perspective, we have numerous partnerships to be able to do that. And this can take place through lending to banks directly, all the way to guaranteeing through the ARIA platform that I will discuss in a second. We are looking how to be creative, right, in incentivizing banks that might not necessarily need cash. They have cash, but they want to be able to support areas and businesses that they might see as risky. So how can we accompany the banks on a journey to de-risk some of that capital? So it's not just necessarily providing dollars or local currency. It's about making those banks comfortable in lending to areas of the population that they might not be comfortable today in doing so. And we're developing instruments to do that. So it's also about applying a regional lens. We, for example, support, and you might think, well, what does this have to do with food security? But we are investors in Liquid Telecom, which is a company based in Zimbabwe. It provides crucial infrastructure, internet-related infrastructure, fiber optics to connect the entire continent, including even inaccessible areas in the Democratic Republic of Congo. So very, very key that a point that was made earlier. We need to think about market dynamics, right? We are working to support private businesses. How can the wider ecosystem, that means governments, that means donors, how can they support private sector to make sure that the dynamics where perhaps DFIs don't have an area of influence, they can support those areas? For example, let's not think about price fixing. Let's support more flexible market dynamics where the government needs to support particular areas, do so in alliance with the DFIs in identifying these challenges. And very quickly, I know that we're running out of time. I wanted to share a bit about what the Africa Resilience Investment Accelerator is about. This is an initiative that is funded by BII and FMO, which is the Dutch Development Finance Institution. And the primary objective of ARIA is to focus on increasing DFI investment in frontier markets. We have chosen five countries of focus: Sierra Leone, Liberia, Benin, Ethiopia, and DRC. We are putting a presence in these countries. We've created ARIA country representation in these five countries, and the country representatives are creating pipelines of opportunities. Because we often hear that, oh, it's so difficult to work in these environments, but ARIA has actually proven that it's not about focusing on how difficult it is, but actually these markets offer a lot of opportunity. The ARIA pipeline has 280 companies that are DFI investable. So just to quickly conclude, we have at the moment, hopefully in the next few weeks, one ARIA deal in Sierra Leone will be announced by one of the DFIs participating in the ARIA initiative. And this really pertains to food security. And internally within BII, we are assessing a number of tools to support ARIA deals and are looking into being creative, because it's not just about looking at the particular deals, but also looking at the market as well. What are the issues that are blocking investment in that market, and how can ARIA, through its collective voice, and also through blended finance and all of the other instruments that have been just mentioned, kind of unlock opportunities in a way that hasn't been done before? So I've tried to be concise with everything that needs to be covered in this subject. Kindly let me know if you have any questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Madame Infante. You have smashed it so well, given concrete examples and also mentioned the kind of market dynamics, pointed out the interaction between government and DFIs, that usefulness, and also pointed out the important aspect of the African Resilience Accelerator. Very good points made, and very good intervention. We are running short of time, but I'm tempted to ask your indulgence, if I may, to see whether you could have 5 minutes extra to allow at least some intervention from the floor to what Professor Tiverde and Madame Infante have shared with us, and also an opportunity to ask something to His Excellency. So I see, let me open the question Q&A column. I see mention about fertilizers in Nigeria, the fossil fuel-based agri-input production, which goes against you know, net zero. But also there is a question from Sosens, which market, this is the question, which markets provide practical experience of DFIs addressing food security issues in fragile markets? What kind of intervention are really working? Given that, then the question from Gideon Robinowizi, so given there are so many opportunities in the business space for this company, including other companies in the pipeline, which are investable, what is the additionality case for BII investment? Now, I'd like to propose as follows, to give a 1 minute to Professor Tiverde and give 1 minute to Madame Infante, and then we can close the discussion. You may respond to these questions, or you may also give us like the final the final word, one line. Thank you. Excellent. Let me start with the with that. Yeah.
Excellent. Thanks so much. So I'll address the, some of the questions, but also just to highlight this very interesting initiative area, Vivian, that you mentioned, which has identified 280 sort of investable companies, and it goes to show that I think one hypothesis is in this area is that if you put more people on it, you may be able to source more projects, right? And I think, of course, there's an issue as to how a DFI is allocating the amount of people and staff to be working on various areas, whether it is certain countries, certain topics, etc. But I think that's something that, I mean, I've worked on DFIs for the last 20 years. I do think that is an important issue. It's about incentives. And it's also about funding, of course. Who's funding that? But it's about incentives. And so, but it's not impossible, right? So if somebody says the investment deals aren't there, well, now let's hear the experience from Aria. And you mentioned that perhaps there was a deal upcoming. So we now soon. Well, that's fantastic. So it's happening. And I think that is really, really important message, is that more strategic action and work by DFIs and incentivizing that is really important in this area. There was a question on examples. I think Vivian, you can also highlight to address that. But I think if you think about these two trend problems, is that either it's about importing. The question for this report came from actually the humanitarian side, to sort of say, well, we face a humanitarian crisis. Is there anything that the DFIs in the private sector can do to help with this? And then the countries that are dependent on imports, well, you can help to facilitate imports, right? So you can make that more efficient and so on. And there are some companies that help with that. And I think also the food conglomerate in Yemen that's been financed by the 75 million loan, I think, by IFC, is maybe one example there. And perhaps also the Dahl Group and maybe others, is where you also help imports to address crisis. And that's important for those countries that are dependent on imports. Then those that are dependent on production, mostly, which were actually most of the others in that group. Then the question becomes efficient production. It takes time, right? So there's not that you can do it overnight. You can't address a food security crisis overnight if you invest in production. But it's like Ethio Chicken was the other example, which did attract DFI investment. And that may then also help to address some of the food security concerns, at least according to the reports that were highlighted about that particular example. So I hope that addressed your question, Sostenis. About the climate question, I think, yes, that's something to highlight. I mean, I don't know enough about that particular area, so how widespread the technology is and how much it can easily be applied in other contexts. Of course, we're facing with both sometimes fragile and vulnerable contexts. That's one difficulty for DFIs. The other is food security and agriculture, which is another tricky area. Because profitability apparently in agriculture is sometimes a bit less than, say, in telecommunications or another sector. So that is already a tricky area for DFIs. And then if you then also then think about greening it before something is widespread available, and then testing that in low income settings, it may be tricky. But I would say why not try also to look at more greener ways of fertilizer. And I would say that's so pioneer companies is definitely something to address. So let me stop here. Over to you, Vieira.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Adak. Very good concluding parting thoughts on this discussion. Madame Infante.
Thank you, Mr. Morinda, and thank you, Mr. Willem ter Velt, for the kind of additional points of on ARIA. There was a very interesting question around additionality, and it's a word that we like to use at DFIs, and sometimes we fail to define. So thank you for that question. Additionality means for DFIs in particular, I guess, from BII's perspective, what do we bring to the table as DFIs in addition to capital? So to give an example to the kind person who put the question forward, when we investment teams go to our investment committee to propose a particular business opportunity, an investment opportunity, the investment committee is going to ask us, why should we put our money, our capital in this business? What do we get on top of commercial success? And we really need to have our case together in terms of explaining how is this investment going to improve the lives of the people of that country. So for example, in the case of a recent deal that we worked as a collaboration, BII and FMO, we were the first loan to an Ethiopian bank. Many of you might know that Ethiopia's banking sector was closed until recently. It has just opened, excitingly. And BII and FMO provided the first loan in dollars to an Ethiopian bank, to Dashen Bank, right? So it's not just about giving money to Dashen Bank for on lending. There was a lot of thought about this. This loan is about providing $40 million to Dashen Bank, and Dashen Bank will use those funds to on lend to food and agricultural businesses in Ethiopia. So the reasoning behind the loan goes as far as understanding which are those businesses that will be benefiting from that loan from Dashen Bank to the private sector. How are they staffed? How is that funding going to benefit food and agricultural generally? Is that going to improve exports to the extent that it helps with the forex crisis that Ethiopia is undergoing at the moment? So all of the areas of repercussion that add value to Ethiopia and to the people of Ethiopia just by virtue of making a loan to Dashen Bank. That's what additionality means. And thank you for bringing that. I think that is at the heart of what we do in DFIs. It's not just about providing capital and sitting behind and thinking, well, let me wait for them to come back with a profit. No, the profit is to be circularly invested in other projects, number one. And number two, it's about what else is our capital going to achieve in addition to providing capital. And that will be inclusion around poverty reduction, is around empowering women, access to energy. Every investment is different, but we must articulate it to our investment committee or else it will not get approved. Thank you. Mr. Morinda, you are on mute.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Madame Infante. Just spot on. And I love that interpretation of additionality. It's additionality and development outcomes.
Thank you. That's it.
You know, absolutely brilliant. And so at this juncture, let me say we have a lot of takeaways, very important takeaways from this conversation, that DFIs can invest in business in the food sector, but beyond that, they can also invest in the infrastructure, including transport and energy that support food security. And also number three, that the policy framework is very important for both investment and for food productivity. And fourth, there was the I like the Q&A about production for consumption and production for export, which His Excellency addressed very well. In actual fact, for me, an academic, I go back to the theories from Adam Smith, a concept called vent for surplus. It was done by Adam Smith and then Hiller Mintz, the production that you produce so much to address domestic food security. And in that process, you actually produce more than necessary food, and then there is a vent for surplus export. That is the relationship between production for food for home consumption and also for exports. So you achieve actually two objectives instead of one. So I'd like to take this opportunity to thank the speakers, to thank His Excellency Sarah Ahmed Jamaa, a very busy man, but who has been able to be with us for the duration of the entire function, and also thank Professor De Verde and Madame Infante for these interventions and sharing with us the ongoing work and the investment pursuits here. Thank you all in the audience who have been able to be with us, join us from all countries in the world to share this. And indeed, we will be able to share the recording with you on the ODI website. I know that the session ends now, but the discussion and the conversations and goes on. And more importantly, for researchers in the audience, including myself, of course, this is the opportunity when we can go into the research that are bringing together the DFIs and the private sector. And even for DFIs and private sector, that's where you get R&D within that concept. Oh, thank you so much. Thank you very much. And I think we have come to the end of this important, interesting seminar, but we keep in touch. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Well,
thank you. Thank you.